Well, hey there, boys and girls, moms and dads, and children of all ages, types, genders, modified, others, undecided, and unaware. So, we're back. Fish and Frank here, RJ up in the golden chrome towers of power, looking down upon the world with kind of a thoughtful expression.
Yeah. I got my cup of coffee. I'm happy.
You know, it's weird. It's 180 degrees outside.
Yes, at least.
And what makes us happy, I've got my coffee, you've got your coffee. You know, I remember being up the Deepwater Horizon at the oil spill up there, and I'm running boats, and we're pulling oil booms, and, you know, we're doing cleanups and stuff like that. And I have to start the morning with coffee. So it was 5 a.m. I'm in the queue in my truck waiting to get into the gate, you know, because you got 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, you're running these boats. And the money was good. I mean, you're making $1,000 a day. I don't mind a 12-hour day for $1,000 a day. But 105-degree heat index. And I want my coffee. So I got the window almost all the way up because I still smoke, and so I need to keep the carbon dioxide out, which is the worst part about smoking cigarettes. I'm not going to get on a tangent, but I'm sitting there and I'm sipping coffee, air conditioner on high, max, blowing cold as it can be, so I can sip coffee in the morning.
Yep, yep.
It's amazing what we will do for that fix. Anyway, why is fishing so much better in the old days? Why is it so horrible now, and years ago it was so much better?
Everything was better.
Wonderful.
Everything was better in the old days, wasn't it?
Well, we got to go back to our prehistoric ancestors.
Okay.
You know, I try telling people that when a guy is fishing, an adult male, and not all, but most, are not, you know, guys who fish are usually not very girly. You know, they're actually pretty guys, you know, that we've been killing everything on the planet for like a million years.
And eating it.
What's that?
Killing and eating.
Yeah, I mean, but the scent of an adult male human is repels fish, repels animals. They smell an adult male, and they're like, out of here. But females, adult females, they've never been, you know, as aggressive and killing and all that. So they have not evolved with that same odor. So if you're a woman and you're fishing and, you know, make your husband tie your rig and everything up and, you know, put your lure on or, you know, tie your hooks on. But then take a minute without having any lotion or perfume or anything on, sunscreen, on your hands. Rub your hands everywhere where he touched. Get his smell off and your smell there. Now, you are not a fish attractant, ladies. I'm sorry to say, you're not going to attract fish to you. But you do not repel fish. So you're at a dead zero. You're not an attractant. You're not a repellent. With us guys, we're starting off 30 points in the back because we are a fish repellent. So we use sprays, WD-40, anise oil, fish oils, all this stuff. And the most, I use one that's coffee scented. It smells like coffee with cream and sugar. And it works great. The reason it works so good, it brings me back to neutral. It gets my smell off. And, well, I'm not exactly a masculine, you know, I'm not a, what they call, He-Man destroyer type person, but definitely not a lot of girly parts. So my smell repels fish. If I can use something to get that off, it brings me back and gets me much better chance. People don't realize how many times they're reeling in a lure and the fish, they hear it and they go, whoa, what's that? They see it going by and they go up. But if they have a minute and get behind it and you're an adult male, they're going to smell that. They have the same scent capacity as a dog. So they smell that male scent on there, like, whoa, I'm out of here. And they veer off before they eat it. Where if it's a woman, they're not going to smell anything negative. So they're much more likely to hit it. What guys rely on is an instinctive reaction strike where, oh, there it goes, and boom, hit it without checking it out. But fish can go a week or more without eating. They're the reptile side of them, the more they eat, the faster they grow, the bigger they get, the sooner it all happens. But if they're not in the mood to eat or there's not proper food available, they can go a week or more without eating. And if you've got a fish who's not, you know, really, really hungry, if it's only been a, we were looking it up, and it's, fish takes 16 to 24 hours to digest their food. 16 to 24 hours. That's like me after Luigi's Pizza.
Right.
Pretty much everything else I eat, I'm eating, and then all of a sudden an hour later, I'm like really hungry again. I don't know what causes that. You know, overeat, and then you get hungry again sooner. But with a fish, it's the opposite way. They can take a day, a week, doesn't matter if they eat or not. Brings up a really good point. If you're catching fish on a Thursday, and you had a great day fishing, and you tell your friend, oh, you got to come out with me. There's fish are just hitting all over. So the next day, you go back out, you go to that same spot, and you don't catch anything. Let's see. Well, it could be they were feeding so hard the day before, and if it takes 16 hours, 24 hours to digest the food, they're simply not hungry again. If you would have waited a day in between and you were catching a lot of fish on Thursday, go somewhere else on Friday. Go to another area and see if you can get a good bite going there. If that happens, then you go back to the first spot on Saturday, and those fish will probably eat like crazy. That's about the cycle. Thursday fish will bite on Thursday, won't bite on Friday, but they will bite on Saturday. So if you get a good Thursday spot, and then you go somewhere else and find a Friday spot, well, then you can go back to the first one on Saturday and go back to the second one on Sunday, and you've had four great days of fishing rather than, oh, I'm going to go Thursday, and I beat them up, so I'm going to go back Friday because they were just on fire, and then they don't catch anything. And then you're like, why? I just told you why.
Mm-hmm. And the fish are still there. They haven't gone anywhere. They're just not eating.
They're just not eating.
Well, you got to think about it evolution-wise. If I was a fish and I had to eat three times a day, the more opportunity I am out there eating things, the more opportunity something's going to find me and eat me.
Exactly. Great point.
So if I only have to eat every other day, I have a lot more time to live and to procreate and all the other stuff that if I was eating every day in the same place at the same time, somebody's going to come along bigger than me and eat me.
You just think so much younger than me. you're just so much younger at heart. You're going, oh, if I can eat and procreate and do all this, and I hadn't even occurred to me. God, am I getting old. I mean, 30 years ago, yeah, that was kind of important. Good God, what's wrong with me? Let's go back on the evolution thing. Humans falls into why fishing was so much better years ago. There's something different in our brains about fishing. And it's almost the only thing I've ever heard of where this is true. Have you ever noticed you're sitting and it's a quiet moment, like you're in the car, you're sitting on the porch, and you remember some really embarrassing thing or something really bad that happens to you, and it just pops in your head and don't want to go away, and you almost got to do an like, oh, man. You have to almost say something to get it out of your head.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's because our survival prior to the last 100 years was based on having a vivid memory of anything bad.
Yes, and that's very true. There's a lot of studies out there that say we as humans remember the negative events and we tend not to remember the positive events. And that's what's caused us to evolve and to multiply.
Well, that's what allowed us to live.
Yeah.
If all you remember is the bunnies and the rainbows and all this cool stuff, you're going to die because you forgot about the snake sitting there that was going to kill you, or the poisonous apple or whatever berry or whatever it was. You went, you ate something and it made you really sick, but you survived. You're going to remember that thing for the rest of your life. It's going to be very, very vivid.
Yeah, you know, Joe just ate that mushroom he found on the ground and he's convulsing and his legs are kicking and stuff. You remember that one as opposed to Joe ate that little flower and he thought that was really good and we moved on. You don't remember the flower, but you certainly remember the mushroom.
So if you're ever wondering why bad things come into your head so much, it's the way we survived as a species. People tend to think of ourselves as, okay, you know, I'm going to hunt, so I'm going to Publix, and I'm going to hunt for the kind of cookie I like the best. But if you're out in the wild and things are trying to, you know, kill you and poison you and all this, it's very important. How does that relate to fishing? Because it's the only thing I know where you don't remember the bad trips. You can go out and not catch anything, and five trips. But six trips ago, you caught 50 fish, and they were the biggest you ever saw. They jumped, and you had this great time. And that awesome day of fishing is ingrained and burned into your mind. And you have no idea you went out after that four more trips and didn't catch a fish. All you can think about is how many fish you caught that one time. Fishing brings out the basic contentment, happiness, memories. It really does.
It does, without a doubt.
It's literally unbelievable how you don't remember getting that treble hook stuck in your foot or, you know, the line broke or this or that. What you remember is when everything worked great, when everything was unbelievable. If we go back in time, we had 71. It was a $10,000 fine if from the Environmental Protection Agency, if you polluted something. Well, the phosphate mine up the Peace River, it would have cost them, in that time, probably $100,000, $200,000 to do a proper cleanup or pay a $10,000 fine. So they took a bulldozer, opened up all the ponds, dumped them all into the river, killed our sturgeon. We used to have sturgeon in Peace River, killed 98% of all the life in the river and the harbor. Everything was dead. Took several years for everything to clean out, stuff to come back in. Believe it or not, it's not the radiation, the radioactive stuff. It's not the chemical. It's not the poisons and the toxins. That did very little damage. We always want to think, you know, oh, it's got radioactive material. Everything died from the radiation. Oh, the poisons. And it's not true. They did almost no damage. What does the damage when you have a phosphate mine are none of the things that you think about. And it's basically the same reason our seagrasses are dying off. The phosphate ponds where they put the stuff has just an enormous amount of suspended clay particles. Now, these are tiny grains of sand or smaller particles of clay.
I think somebody said you can get about 10 of those particles in a single grain of sand. That's how small they are.
But they suffocate everything.
And they stick to everything.
They stick and then they suffocate because if it's on your gills, it prevents the water with the oxygen from getting on your gills. It's the suspended clay. That's what kills everything from one of these phosphate things opening up. And what the settling ponds are technically for, really, from what I understand, is to allow the clay particles to settle to the bottom and become dirt again, clay dirt, not suspended little tiny killing machines.
Right. Well, I think that was the original theory, and they found out that it didn't work, that the particles stayed suspended. Some of them did drop out. There was, because there's always a coating of them on the bottom of those ponds, and the ponds get shallower every year because of it. But still, the majority of it stays in the water column. It doesn't go away. That's why they're not supposed to do releases from the pond.
Well, and that was the thing. They figured gravity would take over and bring it to the bottom. And I would say that was a logical assumption on their part. What the problem with the assumption was, It might take 5,000 years. We don't know how long it would take. We know eventually all that clay would go to the bottom. But how many years, decades, millenniums would it take for all that to settle out? That's the problem. Why do I mention seagrass when I'm talking about the suspended clay particles? I hear all about boats are killing the seagrass. Bull. Boats contribute, but it's a very small part, and in some ways actually enhance the seagrass in Charlotte Harbor. That's a fact. At least in my mind, that's a frank fact. Let's put it that way. But I can prove my point. But it's the silt, the little particles of dirt, sand. It's plain, ordinary silt. It's not the exhaust fumes, it's not the gasoline, it's not the oil, it's not the pesticides, it's not the fertilizer. It's not any of that stuff. Just like when you have a phosphate dump, the radioactivity, all the things we think are causing the big problem really aren't it. It's just little fine dust. It happens to be clay dust with that, but the road dust, the sand, all these little silt in the water blocks the sunlight. And if plants can't get photosynthesis, they die. They don't grow. So if you clear the silt out of the water, the plants grow like crazy. Now, this is direct observation science. We had a 2-year drought a while back. And by the end of the 2 years, there was plants in the middle of the harbor that were 5, 6, 7 feet tall. The seagrass exploded all over the flats. Grass was growing all the way up I-75. We had seagrass everywhere, eelgrass, all these other, everything you could think of. Tons and tons of grass. And then it starts raining and the water gets all brown. Gets a lot of silt in it. Goes from the road into a pipe, into a ditch, into a creek, into the river. And all of the farmland up there, and it's not the farmer's fault. Don't blame the farmer. You're just as much of the problem as the farmer is. Look how many houses we have. And you got short grass. You cut your grass so it's nice and short. I do it. But that allows little bits of sand, dust, to go off and go into the swale, into the culvert, and eventually end up in Charlotte Harbor. And it's that little silt that blocks the sunlight. That's our number one problem right now. And people don't want to believe it because it's not sexy.
No, and there's nobody to blame. You know,
we're all to blame.
You know, you can't point a finger at a single, well, it's the phosphate mines problem. They're the ones that did it. So it's a combination of all these things that contribute to it.
So
And some of that's natural cycle, isn't it, Frank? I mean, we have our wet years, we have our dry years, and really wet years, you don't have a lot of grass, and really dry years, you got a lot of grass.
Because of the silt. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you go back to Occam razor. The simplest answer is usually the correct one.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I hear all these people talking about, oh, we're going to do this, and it's a tournament, it's an overpopulation, it's this, that, and the next thing. And, yeah, it's probably all true, but they're very small pieces of the pie. The biggest piece of the pie is just the dirt and silt. But going back to fishing is so unusual, and it invokes the best of memories, which is kind of the problem with the fishing, because fishing's very cyclical. In the 1980s, we had amazing fishing. It was awesome. I mean, literally, the fish we were catching was beyond belief. And then through the beginning of the 90s, there was no fish. You could go out and fish for a month and never catch a redfish. And I mean, guys who actually knew how to fish and could fish, there were just none here. And snook were almost non-existent. Almost nobody fished north of Cape Hayes. The whole upper harbor was devoid of life. It just didn't exist. Nobody fished around the 41 Bridge. The Port Charlotte canals had nothing. And then all of a sudden, by the end of the 90s, we had a lot of fish. Around 2000, from 99 through 2003 was some of the best fishing I've ever seen in my life. It was amazing. As good or better than we had in the 80s. But then we had a 10-year bad, and then all of a sudden it got great again. And then we go into downturn again. There's probable causes for all this. Too many people fishing, too much silt going into the water, lack of seagrass, this, that, the next thing, red tides. Add it all up. But I'll be willing to bet that this is 2022, and somewhere before 2030, probably around 26, 27, you're going to start seeing some amazing fishing, because we had a great year this year. We had a lot of fish this year. Really good year. And it's going to, all of a sudden, we're going to get back in the cycle where there's just a ton of fish. But don't take my word for it. Just sit back and wait. Let's see. But fishing evokes so many wonderful memories and really suppresses most bad memories. Yesterday always seems so much better.
Yeah, and I think fishermen live longer because they have a different level of stress. I don't care what their regular job is. They go out fishing and the mind clears out and the body relaxes. And you get a different kind of adrenaline when you get a tarpon on or a big shark or a big snook. You know, it's positive stuff. You feel good afterwards.
It's really crazy. And like I say, it's one of the few things in life that invokes pretty much 90% positive memories.
Right. And my point would be, you're looking for something to do, go fishing.
It is the best reason in the world to sit by the water and do absolutely nothing. Now, that first 15 minutes is tough. Next half hour is a little tough, but you got to give yourself time to acclimate.
Yeah.
To watch the waves, look at the clouds, see the birds coming in. Then all of a sudden, it starts getting better and better. When the first half hour, we were on our boat, and we were bringing it up from the marina, it was stressful. Hour later, things were better. 2 hours later, it was a lot better. By the third and fourth hour, it was like, oh, God, I love this. Now, it's hard to get back to there. We went out on the 4th of July, and I was very stressed because, A, I had 10 people on the boat, and I hadn't really run it much, and I knew when we left that I had to come back in, make a 90-degree turn and barely enough room to do it, and then weave my way through a bunch of overbuilt, stupid boat lifts. But when I got back to the dock, I kind of hit the vodka tonic a bit.
You did? You did?
Yes. But now I could do it, and I wouldn't be as stressed. But that was pretty stressful. But while I was out there, it got easier and easier to sit and relax and not have to be looking at news stories or this or that or reading a book or something. I could just kind of hang out.
While we were out there, the only reason people had their phones was to take pictures of the fireworks.
Yeah. It was a good fireworks show, too.
It was a great fireworks show. They did a great job in Punta Gorda. And it was just so wonderful to be out there on the water. You know, everything is completely black. It was dark. It was kind of a little bit overcast, so no stars, no moon. And the fireworks were reflected in the water, so they were twice as tall as they actually were. It was a wonderful night.
A nice night.
Yeah.
And hopefully we're going to be able to recreate that pretty soon. And I shouldn't have gone on so long about all that, but, you know, you get this stuff in your head, and I hear people on talk shows and all this and all that, and they're expounding all their ideas on, you know, oh, the fertilizer's doing this and that's doing this. Sometimes you just got to go simple and say, this is what we need to do. And it's an easy fix, but it's expensive. If you go down King's Highway, somebody had a brilliant idea. They made deep ponds, then they made it very shallow with a lot of weeds, and then a drain. So you have a settling area, the grass filtering area, and then a drain, and they did that again and again a few times. And really, that's about all it would take to clean up a lot of the waterways in this country. Simply change the way we allow the water to run off by using natural filters. Weeds, grass.
And there's some great fishing along King's Highway.
So, you know, it's kind of crazy. It could be actually that simple, but that's not cheap, but it is simple. Alicia, did I get that right?
Alicia, yes.
Sent over an amazing picture of all these things, these sea creatures that glow in the dark.
Yes.
It's awesome. And, you know, when I looked at this, the first thing that came to my head was in the old store. It was probably in the early 90s, and glow-in-the-dark stuff was really just, they were kind of getting it down pat. And there were so many glow-in-the-dark lures. At night, you would turn the lights off, and you could pretty much walk out of the store because the walls glowed with all these squid and fish and all these different things. And I looked at that. It brought back the amazing memories of, you know, being in the store. You turn off the lights, going home at the end of the night, and the whole store lighting up with all this glow-in-the-dark stuff. And they had lures with batteries in them and lights, and there was so many different things, all glow in the dark. And you look at this and you think, you know, there's probably a reason that stuff worked. I still have a lot of glow in the dark stuff, you know, to this day. A lot of people still use it. DOA's got a glow in the dark shrimp, and it's actually very, very effective when the water's dark, because it does have that white color to it. And white is one of the few colors you can use in black water, clear water. It goes, it's a one-trick pony. One size fits all. Any water condition, white still works. But that glow-in-the-dark actually does seem to do good. And it's under a DOA popping cork. It's a deadly combo. I love that bait. It's the best way to fish with a lure, but not have to cast and reel in all the time. When you throw it out, the bobber hits the water, makes a splash, the shrimp is going down. You quite often get a fish right then. But if you don't, you just let the bobber drift along. And if you got a little tiny bit of waves on the surface, just that light rippling breeze, well, every time the bobber goes up on a wave and down on a wave, your jig is being lifted up and set back down again. It's called bobber jigging. You don't have to get involved. Let the bobber do all the work. Then every once in a while, you just give it a good hard pull, relieve some, you know, geez, come on, fish, you know, get a little frustration out, smack that bobber real hard. And you can catch fish using a DOA shrimp with the popping bobber without putting all the effort into going to lures, and you don't have to carry bait with you. You just tie it on, throw it out there, every once in a while, give it a good pop. And then reel it in, toss it in another area. One of the big things people forget when they're doing the bobbers and popping cork, if it starts heading towards the bank, the mangroves, the beach, let it go there. Most of your fish are hugging the shoreline. It goes back to the old saying, you know, guys in boats buy a $200,000 boat so that they can get close enough to shore to cast up against the mangroves, because that's where the big fish are. But the guy standing there on the shoreline wants to cast out past where the boat is. Isn't it amazing how our brains work?
It is. It is.
But throw down the beach if you're on the shore. Or if you cast the bobber out, let it get right up as shallow as it'll go until the bait or whatever, or the DOA shrimp or whatever it is, hangs up on the bottom, and then bring it back in. But let it get close to shore. More predatory fish there right next to shore than there's ever is out in open water. Has to be a reason for a fish to live there. If you're fishing open water, and I don't care if it's the Gulf of Mexico, a lake, Charlotte Harbor, a canal, you're throwing out into the middle of the canal or out in the middle of the lake, and you've got a bobber on or even a bait on a sinker. This is like deer hunting. Deer hunting, the guys go out to stand next to a railroad track or a field and wait for a deer to cross so they can get a shot. Because there's no reason for the deer to actually live there. It's just a field. There's nowhere to hide. You know, they might go out there to eat or something, but that's about it. Same thing with fish in open water. There is no reason for a fish to be there. You have to be lucky enough for that fish and you to show up at the same time. Right?
Right, and the fish is hurrying up to get out of that clear area into a more sheltered area.
And people always say, where do you go? Where's the best place to go trolling? Say, between two things. And I would say between two food sources. I troll around Marker 5 because Cape Hayes comes out very, very shallow for a mile off the shoreline. And then there's a drop-off, and then you got Marker 5 out there, quite a ways away from the drop-off, so the big boats know to go around it. But I'm looking at that point because everything that comes along that shoreline in front of Turtle Bay, Bull Bay, is going to get to that sandbar and swing out to follow around that sandbar. It's a great ambush spot. And it's much more likely me and a fish would show up there at the same time. Go by the artificial reef at Alligator Creek and troll down the reef. Not that I think there's going to be a lot of fish on the reef, but it's a great feeding stopover place for all these fish that are working their way up the harbor or back out of the harbor. It's a great stopping point. Like the three holes, the Pirate Harbor hole, middle hole, the 20-foot hole, the one at the top of the harbor. There is actually Spanish mackerel out through a lot of those holes. There's a lot of sharks cruising around out there right now. It's really amazing how much fishing goes on in these different places. Now, why are those places better than a half mile to the east? There's nothing there a half a mile to the east. So if there's something there, a hole, some structure, garbage can, a sunk boat, something for a fish to hide around or live around, or some, you know, a pile of rocks or, you know, concrete, whatever it might be, a reason for a fish to be there. And it doesn't have to be a reason for that fish to want to live there. They might just be going by. But if they know bait lives there, it's now a truck stop. They're going to go there, have a bite to eat, and then move on to the next one. So what I'm always looking for is, where are certain fish going to live, and where are the fish going to travel who want to eat those fish? From that spot to another one, from Mary's to the power pole, Mary's Reef out to the power pole reef, trolling a line between those, you're much more likely to run into that fish moving from one food source to the next. Right?
Exactly right. And probably straight line in most situations, unless there's a lot of bottom topography that you'd be looking at your bottom machine for.
And I could have bought a car with what I spent on electronics, and actually a pretty good car. I got dual beam side scans, I got bottom scan, I got, you name it. It's got every modern gadget on it. I've never spent money on electronics because I actually kind of almost thought of them as cheating.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You're going along and, oh, look, there's a fish. And half the time it gives you an outline of the fish. You could tell what kind of fish it is. And I always kind of like, I don't know, relying more on, okay, they should be here. And the classic hunt and fish. I had a salesman in today and he says, well, you know, you're going to start buying more stuff for me? I said, but if this was 30 years ago, I would jump and do change very quickly, rapidly, and enthusiastically. I don't do that much now. I am not getting out there to jump and go do change. I mean, look at me. I've got the same clothes on I was wearing in 1974.
Yes, I haven't been washed either.
Not often enough, probably.
Right.
But it's funny how as you get older, you don't want things to change much.
Yes.
You really kind of enjoy them the way they are. But one food source to the next for trolling. And we get a lot of Spanish mackerel in the harbor. Now, I love catching Spanish mackerel during the day and eating them that night. One of the truly amazing fish dinners you will ever have. But then you got the cereal mackerel, which they suck. They're horrible.
Yeah, they're like jelly mackerels.
Yeah, they're just nasty. No dots. You got to have lines, not dots. If they got dots on them, yellow dots, let them go. You know, and it's hard because you're out there catching mackerel and you don't really know. It's a mackerel. Okay. And then you go to eat it and you're like, oh my God, is this awful. Now, certain people like it. If you're Latin or from Thailand, Asian, you know, and you've only been here a little while, you'll probably enjoy the mackerel. Because when in these cultures where people eat fish, they tend to eat a lot of the fish. I mean, they basically gut it, but they eat the eyes. They like cooking the head in soup and all that. It's more nutritious. It's actually a smarter way of eating the fish. But I'm from the Midwest, grew up eating Wonder Bread. I'm sorry. I am not that adventurous. You know, I like nice white flaky meat, not oily whatever that garbage is. Kings are not bad, but for me, kings are 50-50. Some of them I have, it's amazing. Some of them are a little fishy for me. I don't see real clear evidence that king mackerel are always good or always bad. It's kind of a middle-of-the-road fish for me, where Spanish, as long as I'm eating them that night, catch them, put them on ice, let them die on ice. And the reason I want that is I want them to die of hypothermia, which when you die of hypothermia, it takes all the blood out of your extremities to pull it to the brain and to the internal organs to try and keep that as alive as possible as long. And it's the best way to bleed a fish without having to bleed a fish. So, but wonderful meal. But catching them, go back to that DOA deadly combo with the shrimp on it. Spanish mackerel love eating shrimp, bait fish, lures underneath bobbers. Now, if you're not trolling for them, popping corks, any kind of popping bobber really is very, very effective on the mackerel. It works great for people who are not good with lures. It's great on trout, any kind of schooling fish, ladyfish, also on the mackerel, because they tend to hit the surface while they're eating baits and making that specific choo sound as they hit the top. Choo. I'm getting better at that. I think my one tooth's falling out. Make the noise better.
Works for me.
So when you make that choo sound or splat and your bait jumps, it kicks in the greed factor. If you go to a smorgasbord and you get 20 items there, we were at one, what's the name of that road? Used to be a Chinese buffet there, and then they put the medical plaza. But anyway, there's one down on the end, and it's a Chinese buffet. It's actually not bad. It's pretty good. Walmart had that little grocery store there, Walmart Home Place or whatever it is, you know. They got a superstore 4 blocks away. Why did they have to put a little store there? I don't get corporate, but that's why I'm not rich.
Tangent alert. Yeah, all right. So let's go back to mackerel.
But it was with the mackerel, they liked that noise. Topwater lures, great for them. That Berkeley prop bait, that is just killer on the mackerel. And you're not going to catch as many fish as if you were throwing a spoon. Let's say you had a half-ounce Johnson Sprite on there, and you throwing that out, reeling it in at a moderate pace, making sure it doesn't roll over when it's coming in. You don't want it rolling and spinning. You want it kind of wiggling its butt back and forth. And that produces the most fish with a spoon. People who fish with spoons, silver spoon, gold spoon, weedless spoons, treble hook spoons, all spoons, if you're not catching fish throwing a spoon, you're reeling too fast. You have to slow down. And I'm pretty impatient, so it's hard for me to reel a spoon in slow enough to get it to work. One of the reasons a Johnson Sprite is a very good spoon to use, narrow in the front, wider in the back, and it gets that streetwalker wiggle to its backside. And it's just voom, one side to the other side, to the other side, to the other side. And that's what makes those fish go. When you're reeling it in, if it's rolling over and over and over again, you're going to get a few fish, but you're really limited in how many you can get if you slow down. The voodoo mullet, did I show you that in the tank?
Yes,
the one that
did.
Wiggles so mm-hmm. nice? Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a spoon because it's so simple to use, it makes it extremely difficult. Most people are not going to catch fish with a voodoo mullet or a spoon because they don't take the time to learn that lure. If you're not throwing it where you can see it, especially if you own a swimming pool, oh my God, you can get great with lures because you can actually see them. But throwing it where you can see it and reeling it in to learn the right speed and cadence to it. And it's hardest for guys who are my age in their 50s, 60s, 70s, that they've been throwing lures all their life. And they go, I can throw a lure. I've been doing it all my life. They don't want to hear it. The people who catch fish with a voodoo mullet, the spoons, are the ones who watch it come back, learn the correct speed, because you have to memorize how fast to reel it. Not too fast, not too slow. Getting it just right is the key. Because it is so simple, people don't think there's anything to learn. Sometimes the simplest things are the most complicated and the hardest to really work it out. And those are two of the best examples. People don't catch spoons, never learn how to throw the spoon to get it to wobble into water, not roll over and spin. And same thing with the voodoo mullet. Half the people that buy it wasted the $8 because they won't take 5 or 10 minutes to learn the correct speed. And I didn't realize that for years selling spoons. And then I was showing people that mullet, and it appeared so easy. Half the people weren't catching fish. And now, when I show somebody, I literally try to make sure they understand it's a very, very difficult lure to work because it looks so simple. You know, you would think, like, walk the dog lures would be the hardest. I'm finding out rapidly, and it only took me 35, 36 years to learn it, that sometimes the simpler the lure, the harder it is for people to figure out. I don't know why that is. I got you at a loss for words.
You did. I don't know where to go with that one.
So, anyway.
I want to go back to the DOA shrimp on the end of the bobber because I threw spoons at mackerel every time I went fishing for mackerel since I was a kid and never realized you can catch a lot of mackerel with something like that until I did a dive with a National Geographic photographer and they were filming mackerel attacking a school of, I guess they were alewives. And what the mackerel do is they hit the bait and they cut them. They get cut them in half. That's what their sharp teeth are all about. So they snap this thing in half. They swallow it as they make the turn, and they come around and pick up the other piece. Well, what the other piece is doing now is it's not swimming forward. It's slowly dropping down, or it's suspended in the water column. And they come back and pick up the other piece. So you have these mackerel nailing this school of bait fish here, making all these little chunks, which the birds love. And they come around, and there's something suspended in the water column, and they grab it because that's what they're looking for on the second strike.
Yeah, you always get the picture in your head when mackerel, you want to do something really fast in the water.
Yeah, but the mackerel, they hit stuff that are moving slower than them, not faster. They don't want to spend a lot of their time and energy chasing something as fast as them.
It's really amazing once you start getting into knowing the fish, understanding how they feed makes you a better fisherman.
Yes.
Now, throwing a spoon quickly through the mackerel, will it work? Absolutely. Jig? Absolutely. But you don't have to do that. You can use a popping cork with a little bucktail jig on it, a DOA shrimp, and they're going to beat the living tar out of that thing. You're going to hook up. It's knowing that you can do both that really makes a difference. And if you've got three or four people with popping corks, you're actually producing almost a chumming sound because those popping corks going off, that tells those fish that something is feeding there.
Right, and mackerel are a highly competitive school fish. And you know that because when a mackerel grabs something and you happen to have a swivel on your line, another group of mackerels are going to come over and try to get that piece away from them, and they're going to see the little bit of swivel, and they're going to grab that. And it happens all the time.
With tandem rigs.
Yes, with tandem
rigs. So you've got a jig on a short leash and a jig on a long leash, or a jig and a spoon, or whatever, however you want to mix it up. But catching one mackerel is fun. But catching two mackerel is more fun.
Yes, twice the amount of the fun.
Why buy one when you can have two for twice the price?
Right.
But it's, and the glow-in-the-dark stuff, I look down at this beautiful picture, and it's all nicely framed and everything. It's Alicia, we really appreciate that. Thank you. On a tangent thing, people always say, what do you remember most, you know, about all the different fishermen and some of the best anglers were women I knew back in the 80s and 90s who I was lucky enough, and I've talked about this several times, especially the old black ladies. They were just, because they were there to feed their families.
That's right. They were grocery fishing, so it had to work.
Had to work. And whether it was mullet, sand brim, catfish, you know, bluegills, whatever it was, they were going to get dinner. They were going to go out. And it was kind of fun for them, but it was also part of the chores they did every week. You know, they're going to have their Friday fish fry and a little bit of relaxing, a lot of, you know, social stuff. Because there was usually anywhere from 3 to 8 women would come in the store at a time. And a lot of what happened to them was people bought the lots they used to fish out of because of the canals. And all of a sudden, where they used to fish, there's a house there and somebody's going, you can't fish here, you know. I get it, it's your property and all that, but it was weird to watch the area change. But, boy, these old women, and they taught me a lot about fishing. I was lucky enough to go with them and learn some of the mullet techniques and how they literally were going to fill a cooler up so that, you know, they could have that fish fry and stuff. And why go out and spend all that money on the food when they go out and have a great afternoon and load up?
And load up, for sure.
Load up. It was awesome to be able to be a part of all that. And it's still fun to talk to some of the older customers who come in and all the different things. And one of the hard things for, you know, me and a lot of my older customers is understanding that, like, things like braided line. You can't use the same knots we used our whole life. You got to build different rigs for some of this stuff. There was some major changes in it. And I had a couple in, and the wife's a big fisherman. The guy fishes a bit, but not as much as the wife, which is not uncommon today. And I'm showing him the rods, and he's picking out these rods for her. And I'm like, yeah, probably not right. Oh, I've been fishing her. I get that. Let me show you something. And you show them some of the newer technology rods that make the fish weigh half as much. And when you're young, you don't want that. You want a big old rod that's going to beat you to death, and you're going to come back and really feel like you did something. But for me or some of my customers, going out and not being beat up at the end of the day, that's a big thing. Love that. Because when you're 20, 30, even in your 40s, if you come back and you're tired, you got some black and blue marks and all that, that's awesome. You had a great day. I don't need the black and blue marks anymore.
Yeah, no, me neither.
So I go through and show them, and I have my magic lead weights and give them an idea of what actually is the reality and the innovation that's taken place in the last few years. It's like we tend not to like technology in a certain way. But I am literally amazed. I'm sitting on my porch, and there was a hurricane hitting Louisiana or wherever it was, and I'm watching it on a little device sitting on the porch, having a coffee and a cigarette. I'm like, really? I can see in real time a hurricane hitting the coast somewhere else. Astounding tech. It, you know, and it's hard because I'm still thinking I need to watch TV. And you know, to get the weather and all this other kind of stuff. And nowadays, more and more, I'm just, why am I waiting for that to come on? Because Weather Channel sucks on a stick. I'm sorry. They're so busy telling me we're all going to die from global warming. I want to see a national map. I want to see the fronts are here. They're going to come over here and do this and do that. Why is everything working? I used to love the Weather Channel. And now they're so preachy. I want the weather. I don't care that you think we're all going to die in 10 years. You know, so I look at it on my phone now. And, I mean, I can literally fire it up right here, right now, and get real-time weather. Now, this station, if there's an emergency or something, tune into this one. Because you get real reports from the emergency centers. You're not getting third-hand stuff. It's actual real first-hand stuff.
Right, and none of our people are going to go stand out in the wind to see what the wind feels like.
On their knees in the ditch so it really looks like the water's deep?
Yeah. No, we're not going to do that. We're going to give you what's going on in the neighborhood. And remember, in the event of a major hurricane, when all the power goes out and all your batteries go down and all the rest of that, the last place that you can get information that's reliable is your car radio. And we're on FM, and you'll get all the information coming from every agency, and that's what we're here for.
And the cool part about it is, you know, we talk to each other, and, you know, we can find out what's going around the area. And it's not, like you say, oh, look at the winds blowing, I'm going to die. And you see four people walking by with an umbrella behind them, you know. Anyway, this has been another interesting. I'm not sure it was good, but at least got some topics covered. We're getting more and more stuff on fishandfranks.com. And if you're a competitive radio station and you want some cool programming, call the station. They got some cool stuff on the way. But Fish and Frank here, RJ in command, and the golden chrome towers of power. We're going away for another week. Bye, boys and girls.
I'm going fishing, hook, sinker, and line.